Motorcycle Road Racing. This is episode number 620. I'm Jim McDowell. With me is Derek Cabrera, and we'll be talking about the MotoGP from Aragon in Spain. So how are things tonight, Derek?
Things are good. It's been a quick turnaround from last week to get this next show out, but everything's been good. Tons of motorcycle racing last weekend. We got some talking points to go over. I'd say it's probably wasn't the most exciting weekend of the year so far, but still some interesting races, some interesting stuff on the track and off the track. That happened. I think that's probably the most interesting thing of the weekend is the whole KTM Zarco Callio saga and kind of, you know, seeing how things landed a bit. But we'll get into that in a bit. But yeah, pretty good.
All right. Well, let's take care of a little housekeeping here first. I want to thank Alan Fleming for his continued support of the show. He is a super freaking cool friend. If you'd like to become a super cool friend of the show, you can do that as well. We can go to our website, www.motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side, there's a Patreon and PayPal link, or you can simply go to www.patreon.com/motopod. Every little bit that everybody gives is greatly appreciated and keeps the show going. And with that, we have some listener feedback. So Michael McLean has written in, and he's helping me out with some technical things about what else, Triumph Motors and no starters in the Moto2 class. So he says, as always, enjoyed the San Marino pod. One clarification, the Triumph triples, just like every triple we've seen from Egos, MVs, and Levadas, Benellis, a Pearly Cube and Yamaha's MT-09 are 120-degree cranks, resulting in a 0-240-480 firing. The issues with restarting them is partially heat-soaked motors, but mostly the Triumph lacks any auto or manual decompression system. The Moto3 engines from KTM and HRC are fitted with automatic decompression, just like any modern 450 motocross bike. The MotoGP bikes have manual decompression poppets since fitting decompression on cams is not allowed by rule. The Moto2 Triumphs are higher compression than production motor to combust the spec brace fuel, thus it's difficult to bump them and get them to fire even given the wide firing order, even in third or fourth gear. I also suspect the slipper clutch limits the torque transfer from the rear wheel to the crank. Compounding the issue is the shower injector system, which is not great for metering fuel at startup, unlike the production motor that uses an injector below the butterfly. Well, Michael, I thank you very much for that. I did not realize that the firing order was on 120-degree crank idea there. I thought they had closed that up to 110 to try to get a little more torque out of the engine and improve throttle response, but I'm obviously wrong. And this is the idea here you have with the hot soak engine. There's a lot to be said for that, because in this week's events with the Triumph Motors, we saw a couple guys fall and bump start their bikes and get them going again, but they were at the beginning of the race, long before the motors would have been hot. So I appreciate everything that you've written in about that. I think it's actually great, and this is what I love about the Motopod community out there. We are not subject matter experts in everything. We're just really fans on steroids, and so it's great that everybody pulls their resource, writes in, tells us when we get something wrong, or straightens us out and helps us all. And I think that was really good of you to write in, Michael. Lastly, Michael kind of goes into what is kind of the first bit of the news that we were going to talk about, Derek, and I thought this was kind of interesting. He says he was not surprised that Zarco was shown the door before the end of the season. How much was due to Progressive being healthy at KTM and being a concessions team? And by that, I mean Progressive is now available to test the bike and new parts, making Mika available on race weekends. KTM being a concession team allows them to develop the powertrain in season. Given Zarco is shopping himself as a development rider to competing factories, if KTM has new parts ready for in-race testing, that they want to expose the parts to a guy who may be working at a competing factory in 4 months. Just a thought. Obviously, your point of the paddock morale was certainly a major issue. So I think we're going to touch on a lot of this, Michael, in the here. But I do think it's all those same reasons. And thank you again for writing in. So, Derek, in the news, there was an article by Matt Oxley that kind of was all about the breakup of Zarco and KTM. And and things. So I found that to be like the most intriguing piece of news that's kind of come out here in this after this weekend. So I thought we'd kind of go through some of the high points that were in there. Now, this was an interview that was conducted by our press conference, I guess. It's a better way. That was conducted by Pit Beyer, who's the head of KTM Racing. And he had a small get-together at the Red Bull compound, their paddock area. And the article is a very long article. You should read it. It's really good. But some key points that he made. The first one for me was, he says, we struggled from the first day when Zarco threw a leg over our bike in Valencia in 2018. It was a surprise that it was immediately difficult for him to reach the level of pole. What do you think about Pit Beyer on that one?
I think it's a fair statement. I think it's clear that that's a fact, you know? I don't think there's a lot of... I don't think that's... I mean, it's a statement. It's a fact. He struggled right off the bat. You could see how uncomfortable he was in those 2 days at Valencia. And you hoped he would get better from there, you know? Think of how many people have stepped onto bikes and you like immediately saw that it was going to be tough, you know?
Ducati and Rossi. Yeah. To name one, right? Yeah.
And even Lorenzo and Ducati, there was... By the second day, there was some... You're like, oh, that wasn't so bad. But Zarco, like, immediately struggled and he crashed, like, two or three times during those 2 days. So, I think from there, obviously that they didn't get off on the best foot. But, yeah, I mean, that statement is just that. It's a statement. It's a fact. So,
Right. I was impressed that Pit Beyer actually told it like it was. Hey, we struggled from day one. Okay, you know. Good on you. You know, he sort of put his hand up and said, hey, we didn't think it was really going to be this bad, but it was. So I appreciated the brutal honesty that Pit Beyer put in that statement. Another key point out of the article was Pit Beyer says, Johan as a person is a nice boy and a strong boy. He's a special character. I'm not happy that we couldn't supply the bike he wanted, but also that he couldn't make a step to help the bike at the moment when it's not at the very top. I found it very interesting that he called Zarco a boy. What do you think?
I don't know. That could just be a language thing. I didn't actually watch the interview.
I don't know which way it was either. I don't know if that was a translation or if that's exactly what Pitt said.
Well, no. Like him saying that. I'm sure he said boy if it was quoted in an article, but I don't, you know, like it could be said in such different ways and with different tones. I feel like, you know, sometimes things just, you know, people when they're learning another language or whatnot, like they'll, you know, you'll say something and it'll be technically correct, but like to a native speaker or to someone else, it's like a little weird, you know. I mean, I don't know. I do think it is odd that he says boy, but who knows?
Yeah. I think also in the article, he says how he split with his manager and that he tried to become an adult in his life or something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing. That's not a quote. That's just me off the top of my head, which also made me kind of think about that as well.
That's true.
It was a really weird way to put it. And again, you know, I'm pretty sure Pit Beyer's native language is not English. I'm pretty sure it's German.
Austrian, German. But I mean,
German like, with an Austrian accent maybe or something.
I feel like those countries also learn English like
yes.
as a second language from the beginning. So I think that yeah. he has a pretty good handle on it. So I don't know. I didn't see the press conference.
A very weird statement.
But also, if you've ever heard Zarco like describe how himself and like his journey, and he also will say kind of weird things like that. Zarco is very articulate, but in an emotional way. So it's really interesting to hear him speak. That also again might have something to do with the, you know, the language and French. But at the same time, there's other French people in the paddock, and they don't speak the way Zarco speaks. He's definitely a very interesting character. And the whole relationship with his manager, Fallon, I think it was, and their falling out, and, you know, he basically raised Johan to a degree. So yeah, I mean, there's definitely some weird stuff going on there, and I think he did have a big transition in the middle of it.
Yeah. I think Pit, I was thinking Pit Beyer was looking at it, or I was kind of looking at it from the standpoint of, because Zarco kind of was raised by his manager, he never really had that normal growing up, if you will, that most kids do experience. And I think what Pitt was trying to say was that makes Zarco very different than everybody else that's in the paddock. And that's okay. It's okay to be different. But, you know, it was, again, another very truthful statement that is the way that Pitt Beyer felt.
Yeah.
So definitely there. He's talking, in this next point, he's talking about the Dutch TT when Zarco pulled in and got off the bike. And there was nothing wrong with the bike. He just came in and basically gave up. And he says, I was very angry there. So long as the wheels are turning and the rider is healthy, you cannot quit. That is telling right there. That's definitely a very, to my knowledge, because I have some friends who are German that I know from work and whatnot. When I've traveled to Europe, they are very much not quitters. They work to the nth degree to make things perfect. And with Zarco giving up, I could see where Pitt would become very angry with that. But
I mean, I think that's just any competitive form of racing. You know, that's kind of the ethos, you know, to not stop, to not pull into, you know, unless you physically can't ride the bike, or the bike, you know, has a technical fault, like, don't, you know, stay out there regardless. So I think that's just a general ethos of any manager. And yeah, if there's nothing wrong with the bike, he has a right to be angry. Obviously, if the rider, you know, feels like they're not comfortable and like they're going to crash every 2 seconds, that's fine. But then just slow the pace up and come in last, I guess. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's mentally difficult for Zarco to do that, but, you know, rightfully so. I think that's regardless of culture, it's any racing mentality is that, I feel like, you know?
Yeah, I see your point. I get it. Again, it's one of these ones where I think it underlines Pit Beyer's undeniable passion for motorcycling and trying to lead KTM to victory. And his ethos, Pit Beyer's ethos, is I want to win. I want to do everything I can to win. I am trying to hire the best engineers, the best mechanics, the best riders, and I expect 150% out of everybody.
Yes, especially when you look across to Paul and his attitude and his like fiery nature, you know, like he gives them what they want. He embodies the, you know, KTM and their philosophy, so that then on the other side of the garage, have someone that isn't doing that, it's hard to take. I don't know. I thought that was quite interesting. I guess going on to his other statements that you have outlined here, he's quoted as saying, we've learned that there are two different characters of bikes in MotoGP. There are bikes that are easier to ride, and then there are bikes that need to be ridden with a different riding style, which are the bikes you need to win races. You know, which is an interesting statement, and I think is a very true kind of categorization of MotoGP to a degree. KTM and Honda stick out in one group. Suzuki and Yamaha stick out in the other group. Ducati's kind of in the middle because they compromise a bit. And then, unfortunately, Aprilia's probably more in the Honda KTM realm, but not because, you know, they're the most powerful beast of a bike, though they showed this weekend that they actually do have an engine they have a different reason for being a difficult bike. But yeah, I think it's that's an interesting statement, but also a very true statement. I think what we're grasping here is Pitbired isn't telling anything that's not true there. But yeah, what's your take on that?
Well, I thought it was interesting. It's a very interesting look at a paddock insider's view of the paddock. And it's a view that I've held about the way these bikes are for some time. I just didn't know if it was really truly that way. It implies to me that, hey, look, you can have a really perfect motorcycle and ride it apex to apex, sweeping curves and everything, and it'll be fast. But it's not going to win you races unless you sort of grab it by the horns and force it to your will and make it win. And it was just a confirmation for me of what I thought for some time.
Yeah, so, that was, again, another solid statement from him. And the last point that you have here is he said that what I saw in Johan was this. What a fighter. He didn't care what material he had. He just took his bike and went faster. We saw that. We said, wow, we need that guy. Today, I wouldn't sign a Yamaha rider, which I think is also a really interesting statement.
Yeah, that one surprised me.
Because the funny thing is we saw Johan on the Yamaha when it wasn't working right, and he made that bike work for him regardless, which I think is kind of a parallel. It's like that bike wasn't working, and Johan's mentality was, I'm in Tech 3, I have what I have, I'm going to make what I have work. And he really embodied that, and he really did a very good job of that overall. And then, you see that him going to KTM, that mentality didn't work because I guess he wasn't getting anywhere near the results that he wanted, so the morale was down as well, which is understandable. I think him not wanting to sign a Yamaha rider again, I don't think that's necessarily just from the facts, right? So Pol and Bradley came from Yamaha, but they came from Yamaha designed off of Bridgestone tires. Pol's done a great job. Bradley was doing good, but again, Pol's riding style, even he was having trouble with the Yamaha because he was being too aggressive on the Yamaha. So that worked out. But let's look at Zarco. He struggled on the KTM. Cyrin struggled incredibly on the KTM and had a very good year on the Yamaha. So I think the Yamaha where it is today, and the bike that it is, and the riders who do well on it, their styles and what they learn aren't suited for obviously how the KTM is set up. And I think KTM has an incredible pipeline of riders with Oliveira and Binder coming up. And if they are shown that this is a MotoGP bike and they don't have another reference, that is their reference, I think they're going to be in a much better place, especially with the progress they've been making. So I think that's a bold statement, but I think for where MotoGP is right now, I think it's a very fair statement for them.
I couldn't agree with you more. So enough of the Zarco KTM Exodus talk. We'll move to the last few pieces of news. Yamaha has suffered so badly in recent seasons that it has hired Ducati electronics engineer Marco, I think it's Fierro, to crunch the zeros and ones for next season. So Yamaha has now poached a Magneti Marelli specialist so that they can hopefully get on top of this electronics stuff. Marcel Schroeder, he had broke his collarbone. We had that last week, but what I did not know was he broke his collarbone in four places. So it was four individual bones, pieces of bone that had been screwed and plated back together again for him. So he missed Aragon. Fanati missed Aragon as well. And to add to the injured list, Pol Espargaró crashed in FP4 for MotoGP, and he has, I believe, a fractured left wrist as well. So that wraps up the news. Unless you have anything else you'd like to expand upon, Derek.
Nope, that's about it. That's the injury report. That's the Zarco conversation in depth. And with that, I think we can move on to the racing and Moto3. And we can start with just fast forward a bit ahead to Moto3 Q2.
Moto3, yes. So, basically, Kinnett had to came out of QP1, so he looked like he had his normal qualifying woes. But in QP2, it got weird because Kenneth did not set a time right off the bat. He was doing his usual, I don't want anybody to follow me, I don't want to be anybody kind of around me kind of a thing. Eventually he did go out and I think he had some people to chase in front of him, but he put in a lap that was over a second faster than anybody else had put down. And that was pretty amazing, because he did that with about 3.5 minutes to go. He then kind of watched. He was on another lap that was quick, but not as quick as the one he had put down. He was sort of watching the TV screens. Nobody was going to get close to that, so he simply pulled off and let the time run out. But as it wound up, Kennett was on pole. He finished up with a 0.7 second gap, which in Moto3 terms, that's like a lifetime. Agüero came in second to tie the... Is he the Spanish wild card rider for this race? Or is he now riding in the championship, Derek? I didn't quite understand how that was working out.
I think that he is on the team. I think he...
It was an age thing, right? He's now old enough to ride. He turned 16 finally.
Possibly. Was that it? In all honesty, I'm not 100% sure, but I thought I saw a post today that he's like signed to the team. But yeah, I don't know. That's our bad for not following that up better, but I believe he's on the team effectively now.
Yeah, either way, I think this is his first Moto3 weekend at the world championship level. And of course, he knows the track because he's ridden their Spanish championship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to finish and be on the front row, pretty impressive from the kid. Cornfield was fourth, who, you know, we haven't really seen him there very often. Vietti was fifth. Lopez was sixth. The guys that we expect to sort of be at the front, Arbolino, could not get it together in qualifying. He sort of was in the pack, didn't really get a clear lap. I'll try that again. And he wound up in seventh. McPhee was ninth, but our championship points leader, Della Porta, he wound up finishing the session in 12th. Things not looking up for Della Porta, but things looking very good for Kennett as we head into the racing. Anything you'd want to add to the qualifying that I may have missed?
Yes, just to qualify, fact checked. And yes, Tate was a wild card, and as of 9 hours ago, he officially signed for the next 2 years on the Reali Aventia Moto3 team.
Well, there you go, people. Derek comes through in a pinch. Good job. So let's go to race day on Sunday. Basically, this was Kennett's race. It was a dominant performance by Kennett. It was a runaway victory that he had. No one touched him after he got to the front, which did not take him very long at all to actually get to the front. He was pretty much there at the very beginning. It was a faultless ride. It was a flawless ride. It was the most dominant ride I've seen by anybody in Moto3 in quite some time. Would you agree?
Yeah. I was trying to think, when was the last breakaway Moto3 race?
I can't think of one off the top of my head. But
I think Mir maybe had one.
That could be right. That'd be at least 2 years ago.
Yeah, I can't think of a hard date, unfortunately. But yeah, it was in my head, you know, the guy who pioneered the breakaway Moto3 race is Danny Kent.
Mm-hmm.
Not RIP, but for days of old, for better days for Danny Kent. Yeah, it was a very Danny Kent performance where he broke away in really a circuit that he shouldn't have been able to break away at, with that long straight. Was it like a kilometer long straight in the back? That really should have bunched the field up, and Kennett made it work.
Yeah, it was amazing.
There's something about the first, you know, two or three sectors of Aragon that if you piece it together right, you can make up way more time than you can down the straight. So it was quite impressive. And yeah, like I said, I can't really remember an exact time that the last Moto3 breakaway race was. So
the whole fight for this race is basically the second place. That is where the battle was. That kind of wasn't even, if you took away Kinect and you said, okay, well, this is what the lead battle should be, it really wasn't all that changey or argy-bargy of a race. It was pretty straightforward. Ogura was basically second, was second for a long time. People kind of came up, took a challenge. Arbor Lino, for one, kind of slipped up there, and he would run for a little bit with them, but then he would fall back in the field for some reason. I did not quite figure out what really happened to him. But the man who kind of made the best move was McPhee. Now, he had qualified ninth. He actually raced his way all the way up into the front. He was there and was looking pretty good. The big thing here is Della Porta. Della Porta could not get anything going. He was never near the front, wasn't on pace, looked sloppy a little bit at times. He got another track limits warning for this race, and he got it. He kept on going. He looked uncomfortable at best, and then at the end he had finished 10th, I believe, when he actually physically crossed the line, but he was handed a one position penalty for exceeding track limits again. Now, that was something that was clarified at the beginning of this weekend after all the track limits in Misano, was that there was going to be, if you exceeded track limits on the last lap, you were either going to be imposed a time penalty, or if you passed somebody by taking off or going beyond track limits, you would be docked that position in the race. And that's what Della Porta ran afoul of. So here's Della Porta, your championship leader, who, again, has had, you know, he had a chance in Misano to put a lot of points on Kinect, really didn't do it because of track limits and sloppy riding. He comes here and does the same thing again. I do not understand what is going on with Della Porta. Can you enlighten me any?
No, I can't.
Good, then we're both in the dark on this one, because he knew what he did wrong in Misano with track limits. He knew what was going on. He knew he had to have seen his dash. I think it was even on, I don't remember if he had a board hung out that had his name on it that said track limits warning or not, but he knew what was going on. He knew that he was in the wrong, and yet I don't know if emotion got to him or what, but
I mean, it's probably much easier said than done, especially with the riding style that Moto 3 demands, with high corner speed, and you know, you're trying to get every little inch out of the bike, out of the circuit, and especially on a weekend that he seemingly wasn't very comfortable in. You know, he qualified not in the best position, looked to not have the best race pace. So obviously he was struggling, and maybe just trying to get that last little bit out of himself, the bike, and the circuit, he just again continued with running wide. That's really all I can think of. Ideally, we're probably going to some better tracks for the Honda, with Thailand, Motegi, Sepang. So we'll see if he can make that up. Yeah, definitely a tricky back-to-back race weekends for Della Porta and staying within the track.
Yeah, it's easy to armchair quarterback and kind of Monday morning quarterback, that kind of thing here, because, you know, you're not on the bike, you're not racing it, you don't know how hard he's actually pushing to try to make it work. And maybe he had a setup that just wasn't working. But he was not the only person who fell afoul of track limits warning, because Kinect, who was out front, got a track limits warning as well. Now, again, Kinect just probably trying to push it and was over the limit, but he never crossed it again. So he was able to rein himself in or contain himself or settle down and get his head right, and Della Porta couldn't. So I'm not blaming Della Porta, not trying to pick the poor boy apart, but you had other people who were experiencing what I would call similar situations, yet did not have a problem that he seemed to have. So we'll, like you said, better races ahead for the Honda, so we'll see what's going on there. Let me ask you this question about the Moto 3 race. Kinect was able to get away really early on, and as you've correctly said, he was able to string together the first two sectors of the lap, which will give you a huge advantage. If you can string them together properly, you can have a nice advantage before you ever get to that kilometer-long straightaway. But Lopez was kind of at the very beginning riding very well, and he was in second behind Kinnett. He appeared to be like a roadblock, that he was not able to ride he wasn't used to riding a race at the front. He was riding every lap like it was the last lap. He had his elbows out. He wasn't letting anybody try to get by. He was, you know, kind of block passing here and there. Do you think that had an effect on the race?
It obviously did, but not to any degree that it would have changed the result.
I agree with you.
I think in Moto 3, if it wasn't Lopez, it'd be someone else doing the same moves. You know, people are just passing to get in front of each other. I don't think it really would have changed the outcome. But I also think because Lopez is a super young kid, right? He's like right at the age limit, or maybe just a year after, maybe 15 or 16 or 16 or 17.
16 or 17, I'm not sure which. Yes, he's very young.
He's pretty young. And while he is fast and he showed a lot of promise, which is why he's on the team he's on, he hasn't really been at the front very often. So, and when probably the last time was Jerez?
I think so, yes.
So, you know, he's probably like, you know, really just fighting to be in the front. So, I can understand his position there, but I don't think it would have changed the outcome of the race at all.
Yeah, the one thing that I truly know, there's a difference between riding at the front and racing at the front. They are very, very different things. So we'll have to see how this pans out. But that's pretty much the race. Kinnett wins. Agura is there in second. Foggia had a very nice race to finish third. He battled it out with McPhee and got the better of him on the last lap to on the podium. McPhee fourth. Lopez was fifth. Suzuki sixth. Garcia seventh. Arenas eighth. Rodrigo 9th, and Arbolino had fed on the 10th. 11th, of course, was Teleporta. Tsutai, after the brilliant qualifying and being on front, he wound up being at the back as well and had fallen down. Again, different racing at the front as opposed to riding at the front. And that's pretty much how it finished out. In the championship standings, we have Teleporta still leading. He has 184 points. It is only a 2-point difference to Kinnett, who is in second at 182, obviously. Arbolino is third at 155. His championship challenge kind of took a bad hit by only finishing 10th this week. Then there's John McPhee now on 126. Then Ramirez, Antonelli, Masaya, Vietti, Agura, and Suzuki. And that's Moto 3. Anything else about Moto 3 we didn't touch, Derek, that we should?
No, that's about it.
Let's move to a Moto2 qualifying. In the first qualifying session, DG Antonio, our pole sitter from last race, is in there. It has to come through Q1. So does Bezzecchi, Manzi, and Bastianini. The people getting out are DG Antonio, Bezzecchi, Chantra, the tie rider, and Locatelli. Now, in this second qualifying session in Moto2, Alex Marquez goes out, puts down a blistering lap record pace run. And that will secure him the pole position. Other people try to take a run at him, but were not able to get there. It was a very uneventful race, uneventful qualifying session, I should say, as really nobody could figure out how to go fast. Now, they did move the qualifying order around. It was a race order got moved around, but the qualifying was late in the day. It was very hot on Saturday, but for Marquez to put in a record lap was pretty impressive riding. Fernandez did his best to keep Marquez in sight. He qualified second. Bender on the KTM qualified third with a late run where he took a jump up the standings. So I was wondering if Bender had something or if this was sort of a one-lap wonder that he was able to pull out. Marini was fourth. Luthi was in fifth. Navarro on the first of the speed-ups was sixth. Vierge seventh. And Baluiga and Lowe's was there in ninth. So that was your first two rows. Again, not a very eventful qualifying. It was pretty processional, and there wasn't a lot really going on. Anything I may have missed, Derek?
No, that was kind of it. It was nice to see Luca Marini a bit competitive, more competitive than he has been lately. But Yeah, between that and then DiGiantonio having a rough weekend, as well as Remy Gardner, which was surprising. I think that those were kind of the standout things to happen in qualifying. But yeah, like you said, like from a session point of view, a bit processional, a bit boring. But it decided the front row, which looked to be a very competitive front row.
It sure did. As the lights went out on Sunday for the start of the race, Bender got the whole shot. And he was really the only guy who was able to start on the dirty side of the track and go to the front. Everybody, you know, pole position is on the out on, it would be as you're looking at down the straightaway at the bikes, is on the left-hand side or the racing line, if you will, as you're approaching turn one. And Bender was able to get a whole shot coming out from that dirty area at the bottom. He kind of took off, and what was interesting was he was there, and I expected there to be more of a fight for him with Fernandez and Marquez. They were all sort of there together until we got to turn nine. And poor Fernandez, he wound up with a front end slide in turn nine that he slid, he caught, slid again, and then could not catch it. So he was actually down on the first lap. So the man who was second in the championship to Marquez was down. And this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning with the triumphs. He was actually able to pick that bike up and actually bump start it again and get going. And that, I thought, was pretty doggone interesting. Again, probably because of the heat soak thing that Michael had clued us into earlier. But also the fact is the track goes downhill at that area. So you did have some help with gravity and other things. There's a lot of marshals that were pushing as well. So it was good to see that Fernandez was able to get back on the bike, but it did take a little bit of time, so that pretty much kept him out of the points for the rest of the race. Now, Bender had the lead. Marquez was there with him. Marquez tried to keep him honest at the beginning, but what really kind of happened was that these five guys that were up front, which was Bender, Marquez, Lucchi, Vietti, and Lecuona, were all right there, and it was pretty tight racing for a little bit, but what was happening was each little bit, Bender kept pulling away a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. He just kept pulling away. And I was trying to think, like, is he burning up the tire? Is he going to lose that edge grip? We know Bender has won at Aragon before on a Moto2 bike, so there he does go well there. Maybe this was just, it was suiting him, but I really thought that the pack was going to get him. That he was going to become swallowed up. But however, he never did. Bender actually won the race kind of going away. He had a 7/10 of a second lead over what eventually was Navarro, who finished in the second place. Marquez was running at the front, was running close. He had a couple of great moves on Marini while they were having that battle tossed back and forth at the front. But he settled in. Couldn't run the pace of the two guys in front of him. Decided that third was the best place for him to go. He also did they show Marquez that that Fernandez was out of the race? I didn't know if they did or not. Did you catch that, Derek?
No, I didn't see if they showed Alex if Fernandez was out. But regardless, either way, I think he. His whole goal was to just get as many points as possible. And I think that's what's really changed in his mentality this year, is just basically doing what Mark is doing. And just like, if you can't win that day, take the max points, be consistent and don't crash out. So yeah, I don't know if they showed it to him or not, but I think that was his MO.
Yeah, I think that was his MO. I think it was definitely these are as many points as I can possibly get. And that's what I'm going to take. Nobody is near me, and I'm going to cruise it home in third. And that's what he did. Then you had Marini was fourth. Lowe's, because there was like a 3-second gap back to Marini. He had fallen off the pace. Lowe's was only about 3/10 back of Marini in fifth place. That's one of the best races I've seen Lowe's actually run in a long time. Would you agree?
Yeah, it was his first top five and a year, I think they said. Like, it's been quite a while.
Yeah, it was a long time.
But you know, maybe that's just a confidence thing. You know, he knows where he's going next year. He's going to be on one of the top teams. He can relax a little bit. And
he doesn't have to impress anyone right now, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe that stress-free environment is helpful for him. But yeah, one of the better races Lowe's has run over the course of the past couple of years, in all honesty.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that Luthi, who had started strong, fell back to sixth and finished there. Lecuona was a fighting seventh. Then you had Baldassare Martin on the other KTM, Verhe, and then Fabio DiGiantonio finished 11th. He could not really get anything going this weekend. Amazing the difference between what a week makes. DiGiantonio was second on the podium, looking really strong on that speed up. This time around, he is beaten convincingly by his teammate, Jorge Navarro, on a speed up. The ups and downs right now for that kid's pretty amazing between the two weekends. So hopefully he sort of puts it together and gets it more consistent. Again, you know, he is a rookie this year in Moto2, so next year he'll probably fare a lot better, try to not have as many peaks and valleys.
Yeah, but I mean, overall it was a good weekend for speed up. There was almost a great battle, but yeah, Binder just held on, and that was pretty much that.
Yep. Yeah, that's it. So the championship standings, you have Alex Marquez still leading. He is on 213 points to Jorge Navarro, who's now on 175 points. So that means he got by Augusto Fernandez, who's on 171. The non-point score for Fernandez hurt him pretty bad. That puts him 32 points behind Marquez now. So it's not over, but Marquez is definitely sort of re-cemented himself as the man to beat in this championship. After Fernandez in third, then it's Luthi, Binder, who has, with that win, surges up the point standings. Baldassare, Marini, Schrader, then Fabio DiGiantonio, and Bastianini rounding out the top 10. And that's Moto 2 from Aragon, which now Derek leaves us only with MotoGP.
Big one. So yeah, we can hop into qualifying one.
Yeah, there's a big story there in qualifying one, that's for sure.
After you, take it away.
So Morbidelli, Petrucci, and Rins are in Q1. Rins being the obvious one that you wouldn't think would be in Q1, but he is. Now Rins sets the pace, but Morbidelli nips him just before they pit for their second runs. Rins goes out and puts on a hard rear tire, so he gambles on a hard rear. And Morbidelli gets a new soft. Rins is looking okay on the hard, but he isn't setting the world on fire. The hard's going to take a couple of laps to reach its optimum grip, so this should work out. There's enough time for him to get that tire working. Meanwhile, Morbidelli puts in a stinkingly fast lap to go first, but he tows Iannone around to nab second. So now Iannone is going to qualify, and Rins has been pushed down. Rins is starting his last lap, and it's an all or nothing for him. You know, the tire should be up to temperature, it should be running, and he should be able to put in something good. The first sector's red, the second's orange, so he's lost a little bit of time, but he's still okay. Then Nakagami adds a little more pressure by going to third, so Rins has been dropped to fourth. Rins does everything he can, but he loses more time in sector three. So it's all down to the last sector, and Rins comes up short, and he's third. So Morbidelli and Iannone on the Aprilia move on to Q2. A bold strategy by Suzuki to go on a hard tire that did not pay off, Derek.
Yeah, you know, trying to save those softs or what? You know, I assume they were just trying to save one for the next session, confident that he'd be able to get in, but that clearly was not the case. And, you know, when Rin starts from further back in the field, he's had issues getting up to the front just in general. So it's something we expected for Sunday, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's jump into Q2.
So in Q2, we were missing Espargaro on the KTM because he had crashed at the reverse corkscrew and injured his left wrist. He was, at that time, he was hopeful for tomorrow, but he was found to be unfit. Now, Aprilia has both bikes in QP2 for the very first time, which was really good for Aprilia. Now, we know that Aleix goes really well here at Aragon. That's been his best race the last three or four years running. So it was no surprise that he was going good. But after our first round of qualifying runs, it was Vinales, Miller, Marquez, Aleix, Morbidelli, and Quartararo. But by the second time, Marquez just simply went out and asserted his dominance over the field by 0.7 of a second from Quartararo. Miller, who was having a fantastic qualifying session all the way around, Vinales, Espargaro, Aleix, that is, Mir, on the second runs, you know, not much changes now. Miller goes a little quicker, but he can't really get any higher than third. Espargaro briefly went to second, but he falls back to fourth as everybody else comes around. Marquez and Vinales have one more lap, but they both check up, so it's all over. You know, Marquez is on pole. This is a done deal. This is what we expected. Nobody thought anything could happen, but there's this French kid. I don't know. You might have heard of him. His name's Fabio Quartararo. He goes out on his last flying lap, and he was up by 0.5 on the first sector. Completely amazing. By the second sector, he was only up by 0.17 of a second. So his third split was reduced to his lead only being 0.8 of a second over Marquez's pole. So Quartararo has been slowly losing time, and now he's at the spot where he needs to ride the last sector of his life around. And as he's going around, you know, by everything we've seen, the fourth sector was the worst sector for the Yamahas, and Quartararo loses 0.35 to be second on the grid, with Vinales third, Miller fourth, Aleix qualifying fifth, and then Rossi coming home in sixth. So Quartararo, I think, served notice that he had something for everybody, at least in qualifying. I mean, he's sort of, I would say, getting known as a one-lap wonder kind of guy, but he provided the drama in that session.
Yeah, as he has been lately. What, it was Mark and Quartararo who have had almost all the poles, and I think Vinales got one in Misano, but
yes, it's those three. It's just Marquez, Vinales, and Quartararo. They're the only people who have been on pole.
Not a surprise to see Quartararo up there, but you know, it was I'm surprised how close he got it, in all honesty.
Oh yeah, it was very close. I was thinking after this, it's always now Vinales, it's always Marquez, it's always Quartararo, and the others like Dovizioso and Petrucci and Rossi and Lorenzo are not qualifying well at all anymore. And is this, are we witnessing the generational change now? Are we seeing the old guard, Dovizioso, Crutchlow, Rossi, Lorenzo, sort of fade away, and the new guard, the Marquez, the Vinales, the Quartararo, the Miller, are now starting to assert their dominance in MotoGP?
For sure. I mean, I think there's always a changing of the guard, with the exception to the rule being Rossi. I don't think Dovizioso's necessarily past his prime, but he's, you know, I definitely think a new wave is in MotoGP. I mean, even look, I mean, I guess it's hard to look back to like 2012 with the CRT days and stuff, but even then, I mean, look at the grid then to now. It's really what, just the aliens, who's left of those, you know, Lorenzo, I guess, and Rossi. You know, mm-hmm. Stoner's gone, Pedrosa's gone. You know, Spies wasn't an alien, but Spies is gone. He was one of the few other people who were on a factory bike in the past, 8 years.
Right.
So yeah, I definitely think, you know, it's a new crop of talent, and by next year it's going to be, you know, almost completely revised. You know. There's questions if Cal's going to come back. There's, you know, there's a lot of people going for a lot of very few seats. So, I think we're definitely at that point. We're certainly at a tipping point.
Yeah, Yeah, I think the tipping points here, and that's kind of what I was asking, is are we looking at, you know, Rossi's going to ride seemingly forever, but we are losing the old guard, the last of the old aliens. Now, Dovizioso, he qualified only in 10th. So he had a lot of work to do come Sunday if he was going to minimize any more damage to his championship challenge, or not that he's basically really mounting a championship challenge, but just can he despoil when Marc Marquez will actually clinch the championship, I guess, is more correct. But on Sunday, Marquez got out on a hole shot. He took off from the lead. To no one's surprise, it is Aragon. It is Marc Marquez. It is a left-handed track. He went on to win in a dominant performance. He only won by some 4.5 seconds, but you had to believe that Marquez basically started riding within himself, I would think. He maintained a 4.5 second gap and pretty much ran off with it. The good racing was all for second place, though. Because, you know, at one point it was Vinales and Quartararo that were there, but Miller had actually started off and had got to second. Then it was not blocking Vinales, but he was definitely using the advantages that the Ducati has: great braking stability, very fast straight line speed, and he was making Vinales work to stay with him. But Vinales made a very, very cagey pass around the outside to take a second away from Miller. And at that point in the race, you kind of thought, well, Vinales might have something for Marquez, because Marquez had went with a soft rear. Vinales was on a hard rear. Miller was on a hard rear. Quartararo was on a hard rear. Dovi had started on a soft. So you were wondering what was going to happen with that. And, Miller was definitely running well. He had fallen back there. Quartararo fell off early on in the race because, you know, he had the hard tire. That was not the tire to be on. We would learn that as the race went on. And Quartararo just kind of piddled around back there. But the man who was on the mission was Dovizioso. Dovi just kept chipping away at things. He was definitely quick. He was not really setting the world on fire, but Dovizioso had gotten by Quartararo on the backstretch and had moved himself into fourth with 15 laps left to go in the race. So it only took him basically 8 laps to get his way to fourth, which statistically is not that bad. Rossi had no pace at all and was going backwards. Rossi definitely did not. He went with the hard tire as well, I believe, and could not make anything there work. The Petrucci Rins Iannone battle was good. Oh, there's some we should talk about. As Rins at the early part of the race, he wound up knocking Morbidelli down on the first lap as they went into the turn there by the famous rock wall. That's turn 10, I believe. Is it turn 10 or 11? Because 10 is Marquez corner, which is the fast left, and then the tighter left there. Rins lost all of his aerodynamic aids on the right-hand side of his bike. And as a side note, his teammate, Mir, lost all the aerodynamic winglets on the left side of his Suzuki. So the Suzukis were battling for places. They were in the pack and not very good there. Now, Rins did get a penalty for this infraction. He was given the long lap penalty. Warranted, Derek?
And Rins even says it himself that he completely agrees with that penalty. He realizes he screwed up.
He made a mistake, sure.
And afterwards, it looks like, you know, he apologized. Everyone was on the same page with it. He recognized that, and I honestly thought he got away light with the long lap penalty. Really didn't lose any time at all, any ground from where he was.
He never lost a position over it, because it took race direction several laps to actually figure out that it took them several laps to figure out what infraction they were going to give him, what penalty they were going to give him. So, he didn't lose much, but it was also one of those things. It was the first lap. They're kind of in the pack right there. You know, brakes aren't necessarily up to temp all the way, so I could kind of give way to having a problem and a bit of a bump. But he did get in there. He came from a long way back, and I think Rins misjudged it. He was coming from a long way back. I think he went for the lever on the bike, the brake lever, and I think it just didn't have as much brake as what he thought he was going to have right then. And, you know, he bumped Morbidelli. He tried to miss it. He couldn't. He just tagged the back end, and Morbidelli went down. And, you know, Morbidelli was kind of looking around like, what happened here? But, you know, Morbidelli wasn't hurt, and that's the best thing. And Rins did go to the Suzuki box and was talking to Wiko's Wilco Zeelenberg. Wow.
I didn't even know who you were trying to talk about. So
Rins's manager's Wilco Zeelenberg.
Rins and Davide Brivio were there, then Frankie and Wilco, and
yeah, that was Morbidelli's manager. Yeah, sorry. But Zeelenberg, he was talking to Zeelenberg, and basically, you know, Zeelenberg's like, hey, you just couldn't stop there, could you? He's like, no, I misjudged it. I'm sorry. And they brought Morbidelli out. They shook hands. Morbidelli wasn't really happy with Rins. I don't blame Morbidelli for that one. But, you know, hey, Rins did the right thing and apologized. So I was happy to see that. If we get back to the racing, after Dovizioso had climbed up to fourth, he got past Quartararo, he just kept chipping away. That never give die spirit that is Dovizioso. So that took Dovizioso all the way up to second. He actually did get past Vinales. He just used the power of the Ducati in the backstretch to go by. But what was interesting was that Miller kind of latched on to Dovizioso and rode with Dovizioso. Now, Miller had actually noticed or was using up the tire, he said, at the beginning until Dovizioso came by and he learned some new lines, because Dovizioso was riding much tighter lines, much more on the inside, getting the bikes turned upright a lot more and using a lot more of the acceleration and not hurting the tire so that he would have a lot more edge grip later on in the race. So Miller started to do the same, and that allowed Miller to tag on, ride with Dovizioso. So Miller actually gets Vinales as well. I don't think Miller needed any more tire. Vinales was going backwards anyway because of the wrong tire on the Yamaha. But the race finished off with Dovizioso in second. Miller was on the podium, which was a great effort for Miller. I was really happy for him. Then it was the Yamahas of Vinales and Quartararo. Crutchlow had a quiet race and got to sixth. Then it was Espargaro on the Aprilia finishing in seventh, which was a really good race for him. What was interesting, and I read this in a Matt Oxley article in Motorsport Magazine, was the reason the Aprilia goes so well at Aragon is the fact that all the corners are long corners, and most of the time you are braking on the side of the tire. You're braking with like 20 to 30 degrees of lean on the motorcycle, which, according to Espargaro, he says that the Aprilia does not brake well on a straight line because they do not have the right weight transfer. They're not able to use the grip of the rear Michelin to brake. But if it's leaned over and the tire is already biting the asphalt, they can brake really well on it. So it isn't that it's just Alesha's favorite track. It isn't just that he rides differently there or just puts the bit between his teeth. It's the fact that the Aprilia, due to that one particular circuit of having these corners where you're constantly braking on the edge of the tire, benefits them and their handling of their chassis, because they were still had like a like almost a 5.5 mile per hour disadvantage on the kilometer long backstretch. So I thought that was really interesting, that that's how Aleix was actually making up all the time, is because you could brake on the side of the tire.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the Aprilia do so well there. And yeah, like you said, it's not just the leash. It's, you know, he had a good result too. And we saw it not, you know, I thought it would just get like blitzed down the back straight. That didn't happen. It had, the engine obviously works well. It's just everything else with the bike, but we'll see what their radical new design for next year is and see if that is a step forward or not. But it was nice to see Aleix have a solid outing.
Yeah, it was very nice. He was sort of the, Marquez was the star of the race, but honorable mentions to Aleix, because he rode great. I mean, on a bike that's not that good, he rode very well. Even Iannone was really good, which he was 11th, which is only four places behind. I mean, Aprilia almost had both bikes in the top 10, which that would have been fantastic for them. But KTM, they struggled to get anybody home without having Espargaró or Pol on the bike. They pretty much had to go with Oliveira and with Mir. With Oliveira. And he was the first KTM home, and that was in 13th. So it wasn't a good day for them. It's kind of interesting. The fortunes of Aprilia and KTM kind of go up and down in opposite cycles of each other, sort of. One time when Aprilia is doing very, very good, sort of KTM is doing really, really bad, and vice versa. But good to see. So that's the race. That's how it went down. The championship, it's not a foregone conclusion, but Marquez is now on 300 points. That gives him 98 more points than Dovizioso, who is on 202. Rins is on third at 156. Petrucci, Vinales, Rossi, Quartararo, Miller, Crutchlow, and Morbidelli round out the top 10. So there are five races left. So that's 125 points in play, if I'm not mistaken. 25 for a win. Because we got tie round, Japan 2 is 3, Australia 3, Malaysia 4, and Valencia 5. For Marquez to clinch, he would have to score 27 points more than Dovizioso in Thailand. That won't be possible, because the maximum he could score would be 25, and Dovizioso scoring none. So the first chance we're going to see Marquez lock up the world championship will be the 20th of October in the Japanese Grand Prix.
Yeah, which I don't see him not doing, but
I don't either.
That was kind of it. Overall, not the most exciting race weekend in all three classes, which was a bit unfortunate, but we got some interesting circuits coming up next, so it should be good. And if there's one race we can always count on, it's Phillip Island as well. So
that would be magical. The island always gives us magical moments. There's always great racing at the island.
It should be good. We should have some better races coming up. But that's about it from me. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just the worst race we've had so far all year. I mean, in all honesty, this has been the worst race. It was no discredit to the guys that won, Canet, Binder, and Marquez. But yeah, they made it boring because they were out front and nobody could challenge them. But I don't think that's going to happen at the Thai GP in Buriram. And, what can I say? I've got nothing else.
All right. Well, then, until next time, just listeners, feel free to shoot us an email at motopod@motopodcast.com. You can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter. You can find the hosts on Twitter and Instagram. You can find me at MotoDerekC. You can find Jim at MotoRGV. Find Dave Neal. You can find Andrew on Instagram. You can find, pick a host. We're around. But until next time, thank you, and we will see you again after Buriram.
Bye, everyone.